sleepers sleeping, and I've been dreaming of Delphine
again. She's Spanky and our gang to finish out this program here with a tune called And She's Mine. We heard from Misty Roses, who are doing a gig at the Tank this Wednesday evening at 7. The Tank at 354 West 45th Street in Manhattan. Misty Roses did Dreaming of Delphine. That preceded by the Sway Machinery and a tune called Ahavas Olam from their Hidden Melodies Revealed album. And they are playing Saturday night a Purim Bash at Littlefield, 622 DeGraw Street in Gowanus, Brooklyn. 8 p.m. for that. Slow Six preceded the Sway Machinery with Cloud Cover Part 1 and beginning the set Sun Kill Moon with Tiny Cities Made of Ashes. And that does it for me. I'm Irene Trudell. The radio station is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and on the web at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Too Much Information coming up next. We'll be right back.
just fitted all new cupboards. Oh, this is all really? All brand new. Yeah, no, it's all brand new with the latest colour, as you can
I
see.
I really like
fantastic
it.
Blue. It's nice. Do you
I
like
really
it?
Like, I really get a really nice vibe from this place.
I do. Really, I love the light, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
The colour's great. It's this season's colour.
Yeah, we won't need to do much work on it.
You won't have to do anything. You just move in your things and that'll be it. Yeah.
I like it.
Well, why don't I leave you to sort of have a look round and talk to each other? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
What do you think? Do you like it?
What is going on here? This thing's made of paper. It's made of paper.
Well, how's it going? Do you like it? I don't think you're supposed to do that.
Yeah, sorry, can you explain to us why is the microwave and the cupboards... the drawers, they're made of paper. Can you explain that?
Yeah, there's this new Japanese thing that's come out. I don't know, some new trendy
really?
Thing.
Really?
Yeah,
but
it's great, isn't it?
Japanese?
I mean, it's a new design.
Really?
These modern shops.
Oh, sorry, girls. Sorry, girls. Is anyone listening to me here? I'm saying your kitchen here is made of paper.
I know. Don't you think it looks fantastic? Well, it did do before you ripped it.
So, I sent you the DVD for In the Loop, and I was kind of hoping you'd watch it. And since you work in the Office of Information, Chris, I was kind of thinking you could give us a review of this movie and in regards to, you know, what might actually be true.
Well, I would say more or less everything is true in the movie. It's just an expose of behind-the-scenes diplomacy between the United Kingdom and the United States, and in the particular case of In the Loop, the key first event is really a misstatement by the British Foreign Secretary, and he says something about climbing the mountain of conflict as an offhand remark during an interview, and he just doesn't really know what to say, and this words kind of pour out of his mouth, and from there, really, there is, well, the ball is rolling towards war, and the movie just showed the ineptitude of people that, you know, this thing just kind of kept ricocheting until there was finally war started.
What do you think the funniest thing in the loop was for you?
Everybody that said they were going to resign in protest, which was James Gandolfini, the general, and the initial British Foreign Secretary, that were both the peaceniks in this and supposedly were going to stand their ground, they both in the end fold.
Why was that funny?
It's funny because it's true. I mean, that's the way things work. You have these people that say that they're going to take a stand on something, and then when really push comes to shove, they rationalize to themselves. You know, there was that scene where they're in the back of the limo and the foreign secretary is saying, well, is it more courageous to resign or not to resign? And, you know, there's his two aides in the back was a young guy and then the more experienced woman. And the more experienced woman is just, you know, talking about reality. And she said, well, obviously it's more courageous to resign. You know, you have a position, you stick to it, and you resign if it goes against the position. And then the but and he doesn't want to hear that answer, so he says, "Oh, but," and he just kind of doesn't listen to her. He's like, "Or, but." So what I hear you saying is that it's more courageous not to resign. And she's like, "No, that's not what I said." And the other aide jumps in and says, "Yes, because you know sometimes it takes more courage to do the wrong thing than it does to do the right thing." And then they all kind of fall silent. You know, it's just perfect.
The director, Armando Iannucci, is actually one of the kings of comedy for the UK. He's actually one of my heroes for a long time, way before the movie came out.
Yeah, what else did he do?
In the early 90s, he worked with Chris Morris and Steve Coogan on a radio program called On the Hour that later became a television show called The Day to Day, which was sort of an early version of The Daily Show, sort of a fake news show. And that's where Steve Coogan gave birth to Alan Partridge, and Armando was the writer and director of that TV series. But the story for In the Loop is basically an offshoot of a project he's currently doing. In fact, the third season just wrapped up in the UK called The Thick of It. And it's sort of a behind the scenes with, again, low-level, backbiting folks.
Hey, you're really selling it, man.
One of the reasons I wanted you to watch this movie is because there's a lot of sort of dark conspiracy theories to this movie that all seem plausible, and it's very similar to a lot of the stuff that you tell us on the program regularly. So I'm kind of wondering, you know, for you, what stands out?
Well, I thought that the combination of the internal U.S. Department quip pip memo, the way that got completely re-edited so that its conclusions were all opposite to its initial conclusions, that it was made into a complete fiction, was in there. And that surprised me because that actually happened completely. And you have the Iceman character, who was definitely a 100% representation of Curveball, the Iraqi defector that supplied the yellow cake information that was sort of the smoking gun that we all know now was completely false. But the thing that I found really fascinating was the representation of the incompetence and the duplicity and the backbiting was so right on that I have to feel like he had just almost unfettered access somehow.
You know, Armando Iannucci did go to D.C. to do some research for the film, and he says that he was able to sneak into the State Department by simply flashing a BBC pass that he made with glue and scissors and saying that he was there for the 12:30. He says that's all it took to get past security, and then he wandered the halls talking to people and taking pictures.
No way, man. The only way he could get in is if he had, like, some incriminating, you know, nudie photo or sext of somebody working in security or something that could get him in.
Well, you know, I'm actually going to be interviewing him for the program.
Really?
In the Loop got nominated for an Oscar for the adapted screenplay. So he's in town doing a few more interviews, and I was able to score one for Too Much Information.
Really? You're going to interview him?
Absolutely.
Oh, awesome. You need to ask him, does he have or can he obtain a copy of the original Quip Pip document?
You know, that seems like a little specialized. You know, I was thinking it would be more like, you know, a career-spanning interview. We could talk about the radio shows, the TV shows, the movies. You know, Chris, he actually has a Twitter feed now.
Promise me you will ask him about the Quip Pip document before you ask him about his Twitter feed.
Armando Iannucci, you are a master of all media, radio, television, film, and now Twitter. I've been following your feed, and I have to say, it's kind of like I'm with you at your Oscar lunches. Congratulations, and thanks for coming on Too Much Information.
Pleasure. It does sound like the beginning of the end when you say that my next medium is Twitter. But That sounds like, you know, that you get these celebs and so on who are no longer given programs on network television and who are bitter for the rest of their career and then start doing their own programs online with mock-ups of their chat show set, but in their living room.
Bam.
As if somehow they're still in the headlines.
You know, I don't know if you noticed, but they changed the rules this year for the Oscars that you only get 45 seconds to do your acceptance speech.
All right, I thought you were going to say I only get 140 characters. yes, they do. They've set up a... We all went to the lunch, the Oscar nominees lunch, which was very nice and very informal, really, which is great because, you know, you get the nomination and you don't quite believe it. And people's reaction is one of, you know, joy, but they also say things like, and are you going to the... You get to go to the awards, do you? As if somehow you've been nominated for an alternative Oscars for people who aren't really that important, who get awards in a dark room where no one watches.
You mentioned on your Twitter feed the other day that the name recognition in Hollywood for In the Loop was not very high, but you do have a huge fan base here in the United States. It's nothing like it is for you at home. It seems... Back home, you were very revered and respected, one of the prime movers of British comedy. And your latest project, season 3 of The Thick of It, which aired this past November and December, it seemed also was a hit.
Sorry.
Let's listen to a little bit.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm over it, okay? Don't you apologize. Don't you apologize. You don't need to apologize. I love this place. I do. I mean, compared to number 10, this place is fucking tranquil, yeah? Over there, 300 yards down the road. I mean, it's like a... cancer ward. I mean, there are people in there that are screaming at each other. They are screaming, you gave me this disease. You gave me this disease. In every corner that I turn, there's another threat, Terry. Hacks. Hacks. Vampire hacks. And they're slaughtering us, Terry. They're slaughtering us, and they want my face for a flannel. And you know what? I used to be the pharaoh, Terry. I used to be the pharaoh. Now I'm floundering in a Nile of ish. But I am going to fashion a paddle out of that ish. Yeah?
Good idea.
I'm not going down. I am not going down. Yeah? How are you feeling about things?
Well, you know, I'm just trying to do my best and, you know, make sure I can still get home by 6 o'clock.
That's the actor Peter Capaldi, the star of The Thick of It, and the only character that makes the crossover from the world of The Thick of It to the film In the Loop. And it's really difficult to explain the connections between these two projects. There's a lot of the same actors, but it's kind of like a parallel comic book sister universe of sorts.
Yes, I'm deliberately confusing people's minds who care about these sort of things. You know, the film was there. I knew that the bulk of the audience seeing the film In the Loop would not have heard of The Thick of It. And therefore, it's great if they see the film and then want to discover The Thick of It. That's fantastic. But I knew that the film had to be something self-contained and that would explain itself and each character within it, within the film, and you didn't have to arrive at it with any sort of prior knowledge. So that's why I took Peter's character, Malcolm Tucker, who is the Prime Minister's chief attack dog. He's officially the director of communications, but in the same way that Karl Rove, I think, called himself Bush's
architect.
Architect. Oh, that sounds horrible. Oh, that's even more menacing than I imagined. But actually drove an awful lot of policy along as well as the message. And Malcolm is a bit like that. He's a very vicious, aggressive, shouting, swearing, bullying figure.
Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. General Flintstone. Was it you? Did you leak Pwep Pwep? I mean, I know you can't fire a gun, but can you use a fax?
No, I didn't leak Pwep Pwep. I do everything up front, okay? Not like some creepy little gay mercenary that sneaks around doing other people's dirty work.
Hey, I am doing my own work. I'm doing my job.
No, you're doing Linton's dirty work. You're his little English bitch and you don't even know it.
Have you ever even actually killed anybody? I mean, really?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, falling asleep on someone, that doesn't count.
Oh, that's good. That's good. How about you, piece of drip, ever kill anybody?
Maiming is what I prefer. Psychologically.
Why don't you try to maim me? I'll hit you so hard in the face you'll be missing teeth.
Go right ahead. I can see the headlines right now. Peace-loving general starts fight at the UN, Swiss intervene. I don't know. I'm not an expert on spin. That could hurt your career.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Do excuse me. I've got work to do. Don't ever call me for English again.
So I knew I wanted the Malcolm character in, but everyone else I wanted completely from scratch. And also because there's an international element to the film, because it's about the relationship between Washington and London and the White House and Downing Street, there was going to be a whole US cast involved who obviously weren't in the thick of it. So that's that. But people do ask me why certain actors play one part in the TV show and a different part in the film. And Palmer just thinks, well, it's because it's all pretend, isn't it? You know?
but with Malcolm, it does seem that he's got sort of the balls to sort of will himself into a parallel universe. I mean, did you plan on doing that with him as well, or did he start out maybe a slightly different character as well?
No, he plays the same. He fulfills the exact same function because he is a Downing Street person. He has about 12 or 13 ministries to deal with. You see one of those ministries in the thick of it. You're seeing another one in the loop, really.
It does seem for this character, Malcolm, that he's such the center of the universe for both the film and the television series. You really did something interesting with the new season. He really gets a counterpoint with Rebecca Front, which I would imagine would be terrifying to any actor or actress to sort of have to do this.
Certainly she came on knowing the reputation of the show, and, you know, so she knew there would be a lot of attention on her. But, she, you know, I chose her because she's terrific, and, you know, I've always known her to be terrific, and I've never quite seen her center stage before. And we worked out, she then worked with Peter Capaldi and the writers on what her character would be, and we worked out the best thing would be for her to be kind of come into the job feeling very optimistic, not having had terribly much experience of frontline politics. You know, she kind of rose very rapidly from the sort of low ranks because they basically run out of people, and therefore didn't know that you were meant to be frightened of Malcolm. No one had told her that. And therefore, when Malcolm did, you know, shout at her, she didn't shout back, but she certainly gave as good as she got, which disorientated Malcolm in the first couple of episodes. And Peter really enjoyed that because that was a whole new dynamic for Malcolm to kind of explore. But it made for a new area of comedy. You know, the fact of this guy who used to be at the top of his game and used to be able to control everyone, suddenly finding that, you know, there were certain limits to what he could achieve. Of course, as the series progresses, she gets beaten down into a pulp. But for those tantalizing few minutes at the start, you know, you can see there's some life there.
Any chance we could just skip over the usual abuse bit and move on to the part where we sort this out?
Yeah. You need to make a decision. Are you still going ahead with a private school? Because if you are, we need to draft a statement saying that your husband's leaving his job.
Are you taking the piss? You're expecting me to choose between fucking up my daughter's life and fucking up my husband's life.
Yeah.
So I just have to choose between them, like they're on some cosmic dessert trolley.
Listen, darling, I can't fight on two fronts, you know? If the press run with both these stories, you're dead.
You set this up, didn't you?
What?
To put me in my place, or get back at me for ignoring your advice, or some other weird perceived slight that doesn't in any way merit this massive out of proportion Israeli style response.
Well, watching the thick of it, I couldn't help but think you must be allowed to do whatever you want on television. I mean, I have this scene stuck in my head where you kind of walk into the Office of Comedy Commissions or whatever you call it there, and you say, hey, I'd like to do a comedy program about, and then you just say the first thing that pops in your head. And, you know, I imagine the other guy on the other side of the desk be like, hey, all right, Armando, here's a giant pile of money. Let me know if there's anything we can do to help.
That implies, you know, I could just, you know, I would like to do a 26-part series about plant fondling. Now, no one's going to pay me to do that, you know, unless I storyboarded it and, you know, it doesn't really work like that. I mean, I've been making comedies for the last sort of 15 or 20 years, really. I don't know why I said 15 or 20. That sounds like the two are quite close.
But come on.
But so, you know, unfortunately, you know, there have been various sort of hits in that time. So, you know, I'm lucky to have a bit of a sort of track record. But that doesn't mean to say I get an automatic green light on anything.
Well, come on. I talked to a couple British comedians, and we were talking about the language, for example.
Yes.
In the thick of it. And they're like, we don't know how he does this. And it does seem that you proposed a show about the walking F word.
No.
Who shouts at everybody else.
What happened was 20 years ago, just as it was starting, I paid for a number of private investigators to shadow and photograph the most promising people in broadcasting in Britain, on the understanding that they would eventually become commissioners and network controllers. And therefore, I built up a bucket full of compromising photographs and information. That is, you know, that's the awful truth. It served me in good stead. I'm now thinking about the plant fondling idea, and I think it's a good one. And so I'm going to dig into the bucket, pull out the compromising photographs, walk into that person's room, show them the photographs of him and the dog, and say, green light it.
You do allude to this behavior in the latest season when Malcolm, talking to his counterpart, brings up a photo that he's saving.
Oh, yes. No, he's the Shadow Chancellor. Yes. Well, there are all sorts of rumors that go around Westminster. Yeah, so.
You know, I have got in the back of my Nikon filing cabinet, I've got a Nikon photograph that I've been waiting for a Nikon rainy day to show everyone, which is a photograph of you, Nikon Shadow Chancellor, at one of his Nikon parties, dressed up in Nikon bra, suspenders, and blackface.
The thing about doing a fiction is you can allude to things that are kind of known within certain circles, but which you know legally you would never actually be able to state as categorical fact.
So how comfortable are you then with someone not taking you to task for how you're making stuff up, but on the other hand, sort of celebrating that this perhaps might actually be a better version of journalism than perhaps what we got?
I just feel, you know, I'm making a comedy. That's all I'm doing. It's up to journalists or it's up to politicians to demonstrate that it's not true.
You know, I imagine today that a lot of younger comedians turn up at your door looking for advice, guidance, wisdom. Armando, please tell me how to climb the mountain. Do you feel comfortable being in this position?
No, it's, you know, all I say to people is, you know, and I've got to clarify, you know, it's not an automatic thing. You know, I've had, you know, for every project I've had on, I've had two or three turned down. You know, it's just a... It's just the more experience you get, the more you feel you can find a project that people might think is something that they want to see. But what I say to people starting off is like, always be true to yourself. Always write what makes you laugh. Don't try and write what you think someone behind a desk with the commissioning power will laugh at, because you'll end up writing not to your strengths, really. And the only way you can get on, really, is if you, or the only way you can live with yourself is if you make stuff that you feel is like doing what you want to do and getting your enthusiasm behind it.
You know, on the surface, your own biography kind of reads like a how to fall into comedy by accident, you know, but there do have to be some through lines, especially with hindsight. Can you share the origin story for Armando Iannucci, comedy writer?
Oh, wow. Oh, gosh. But I've always just loved comedy. You know, as a kid, I listened to lots of radio comedy shows. I did my first stand-up when I was about 12. At school, kind of end of year concerts and so on. At university, I would do comedy and write my own one man shows and things like that. I used to do this demented Scottish comedian called Ken Theft, who spoke very slowly like that, and he would do poems. He would go red shed, blue shoe, magenta placenta, off-white pink with a hint of russet, it doesn't have to rhyme, does it? And things like that. And just seeing what you could get away with, really, and I try to make it as strange as possible, just to see, you know, when people would stop laughing.
Isn't this sort of side activity to your official academic life as a promising Milton scholar?
Well, I spent 3 years trying to write a PhD on Paradise Lost. And I never finished it. The only thing I picked up from that time, which I can remember now, is that the opening lines of Paradise Lost, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree, have the same rhythm scheme to the theme tune to the Flintstones, of man's first disobedience and the fruit of that forbidden tree. So whether the composer of the Flintstones theme tune was inspired by Milton, or whether Milton in some crazy creative way was anticipating the genius of the Flintstones, I don't know.
Now, I imagine these sorts of connections happen for a lot of over-caffeinated thesis writers. But for you, when you made this connection, what happened?
I thought I shouldn't carry on in academia and should maybe go into comedy, which is what I did. And I sort of set off to try and carve out a career as a stand-up, but I was approached by... I grew up in Scotland, in Glasgow, and Radio Scotland were looking for some younger music show presenters, really. And I got asked if I wanted to do that. They'd heard some of my stuff, and I got asked if I wanted to do that. While I was doing that, I was allowed to write comedy for the show, and I went on to kind of help in the production of it, the editing, the acting, and the sound effects. It was a real crash course in radio production, really.
You know, you recently produced a television documentary on Milton, which again suggests that you can do whatever you want. It is lovely. And I don't know how this works where you come from, but here, when actors and comedians do television that, you know, is supposedly deep thinking, yeah, it's really bad. But your Milton show kind of comes off like a love letter to the Armando who stopped writing his thesis. Let's listen to a little bit.
When William Blake read Paradise Lost, he wondered if Milton was of the devil's party without knowing it. Blake should have given Milton more credit. He's a lot cleverer than that.
One who brings a mind, this is Satan talking of himself, a mind not to be changed by place or time. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven. That's Satan saying, I can take words, words that mean the opposite of each other, and yank them together, and somehow they will impress you, they will make you feel that I've somehow come up with an argument that is persuasive. Make a heaven of hell, a hell of heaven. Here is the start of spin. This is poetry telling us what spin and argument is all about. The sort of politician who says, forward to the past. Let us start building our tomorrows today. Victory in defeat. It all sounds great, especially if you do that with your finger and raise your voice, but it is meaningless nonsense. All those people are literally doing the devil's work. And this sort of play with language, this use of words without really caring what they mean, as long as they sound impressive, even though the words themselves are the opposite of each other, ends up in the sort of pure evil that you see in phrases like work sets you free and the gates of concentration camps. Milton makes us feel that we are not being told that this is wrong or this is bad or this is manipulative. It allows us to work it out for ourselves.
Did you have an audience in mind when you made this program?
Oh, yeah, I did actually, which is an audience who may have heard of Milton and may have heard of Paradise Lost, but who hadn't read it. And I really wanted to convey to them, I really wanted to speak to them, not from a very, very knowledgeable point of view, but from remembering the experience of someone who fell in love with the poem. And trying to sort of recreate, you know, those initial impressions that I had, try to convey them to others, but also speaking to other people who had had experiences similar to Milton's own experience. So it was all about, and really getting quite close up to the language of the poem and examining it, you know, sometimes word for word, syllable by syllable, to see how it worked. Because I think, you know, and I think arts television is very difficult thing, because quite a lot of the time it can sound exclusive, it can sound like it's dealing in a knowledge of literature and a vocabulary that is greater than the people who are watching it. You know, you feel excluded from it, and I always find that off-putting, and I think the only way to want to go and seek something out is if you hear someone enthuse about it and are entertained by that enthusiasm.
It does have sort of a love letter feel to it.
Well, I got a very nice card from my former PhD supervisor who said that I had done more for Milton Scholarship in that one program than I would ever have done if I'd finished my PhD. So that was very nice.
You know, your career really seems to take off when you and your cohorts make the move from radio to television with the program On the Hour. And I know radio is a medium that is very dear to you still, but I'd love to learn about what it meant for you at the beginning. I mean, was the plan always to just, you know, squat here for a little bit and go to TV?
No, I mean, there's no plan. There's no, you know, there is no back of the envelope, 5, 10, 15-year plan. Everything has happened as a result of what's happened before. You know, I became a radio presenter and then made radio comedy. Some of the radio comedy was successful. Alan Partridge developed on the radio. Television wanted it, so we made the shows for television. As a result, I was allowed to make some more TV shows. The Thick of It was this sort of the latest one of those. That generated the film. So it's a game of consequences, really.
But for radio, did you feel that you had enough time to experiment and do what you wanted to
do? Oh, radio is fantastic. It's because it's so immediate. It's so... and also, you know, you can have quite... You can be very ambitious on radio because it's all in the head. It's all sound, you know. So you can create extraordinary landscapes just through audio effects. And also, you can be very topical. And radio was a great... Because it's verbal in terms of the comedy, you know, there's no room for slapstick on the radio. It trains you in script editing, you know. I very quickly picked up a sense of... You know, you can just tell something is too long by just looking at the page and just seeing how dense it is. And you know how long it is to tell a joke and whether that, you know, that paragraph there is going to be a minute and a half. So, you know, yeah, and also every word is important and has to be the right word. So it really disciplines you in terms of construction of gags and lines and stories and so on.
Let's listen to a little clip from On the Hour.
No, I'm talking about the actual corruption of the police.
Oh, sorry.
On the Hour, maximum use of the BBC's news resources.
In 47 seconds, sports news, but first there's been mixed reaction to the news that pedestrians are to be banned from Cambridge city centre. The council ruling follows concern over congestion in the city's increasingly crowded streets. Market traders are up in arms, claiming that already recession-hit trade will dry up completely if no one is allowed to walk within half a mile of their stalls. But the council are unrepentant. There's no pleasing these tossers, said a spokesman this morning. You clear the streets so they can unload their vans, and they turn around and crap in your face.
This is Sports Desk. I'm Alan Partridge. Formula One driver Nigel Mansell gave up motor racing this week as it's too dangerous. And anyway, claims Mansell, I can get the same sensation by sitting in a wind tunnel with dark glasses on and a paper bag of agitated wasps tied over my head.
Now, you keep saying that there was no plan, but I'm really curious about this moment when you started this show. And you know, it seems to me that a new satire like this had never been done before. It was entirely different and ended up kind of changing comedy. And I'm kind of wondering for you, Steve Coogan, Chris Morris, Rebecca Front, were you just hanging out and making this stuff up? I mean, like, where did this powerful, talented cabal, how did it come to be?
Well, I knew some of them. I knew Patrick Marber, David Schneider, Rebecca I knew. I knew of Steve. I had heard Chris Morris on the radio. And I knew I wanted to make a mock news show, a thing that sounded like the news but clearly wasn't, but had all the techniques of the news. And it arose really from my experience in Scotland working on a music show, but also doing, there were elements of features and documentaries and sport and drama all involved. And so I picked up all those sort of techniques and you know, just different styles of editing. And what interested me was the fact that a lot of comedy at the time was really, it was just gags said into a microphone with a couple of sound effects, maybe in front of an audience laughing. There weren't any real, there wasn't a comedy about the style of the medium itself. And, you know, I listened to a lot of radio. Chris Morris had listened to a lot of radio, and he was thinking along similar lines. And so when I got in touch with him, said, I want to do a mock radio show, a mock news show. We just hit it off immediately. In fact, I met him. He was driving this battered old car outside the BBC, and I met him, never met him before. We got in the car, and he was looking for somewhere to park. We couldn't find anywhere to park. So we just drove round and round the BBC for 2 hours, just one block, again and again and again, for 2 hours. But at the end of those 2 hours, we'd come up with a programme. And I asked Steve Coogan to, you know, come up with a sports presenter voice. I said, not really an impression, but an amalgamation of every sports reporter you've ever heard. And I can't do it, but he came up with this Alan Partridge kind of character. And it was so funny because I think when we started doing the show, we kind of knew that it sounded different from other shows. And we thought it was funny, and we thought some people would really like it. We didn't expect it to get the kind of the big reaction that it got, but we kind of were kind of excited by it. You know, I think we did know that we'd done something a bit new.
Yeah. You know, one of the most popular clips on YouTube right now is the How to Make a News Spot bit from Charlie Brooker's Newswipe. Like 1.2 million views on YouTube. And I laugh. But for me, you know, this Let's Be a Media show making fun of the media is an idea that's kind of played out now. And I, well, perhaps for myself, you know, I've watched Day to Day and Brass Eye like 1.2 million times just on my own.
Yeah.
But I don't think that any of the shows that come after this work that you did, and this includes The Daily Show and The Colbert Report here in America, none of these seem to go as far as you and Morris do.
I'm a big fan of The Daily Show. I mean, Daily Show's different in that it has to react to that day's news, whereas we had the luxury on the day-to-day of not talking about the news at all, actual events. We were just making things up, but making them look real. Daily Show's looking at reality and showing how foolish it is.
I feel that there's an agenda with your show as well, though. Absolutely. And it seems like there's these two parallel agendas. One, you know, there's this wonderful biting the hand that feeds you, sort of this media making fun of the media.
So.
But there's also the other agenda dedicated to absurdity and just the ludicrousness of it all. But in the end, it is sort of media criticism in a strange sort of way. And I'm kind of wondering, why was it that the media was such a focus for you to take on?
Well, I suppose, you know, initially, I mean, we didn't have a manifesto or anything. We just thought, let's try and think of a new way, a new hook on which we can hang our jokes, really. And there is something funny about our faith in the media. You know, the more serious and earnest someone is, the more we believe them. And actually, the more you explore how the media works, the more you realize how that's foolish to think that. I mean, Chris and I, when we were making The Day Today, we went on a crash course in news journalism where we had to edit make a report for television news. It was at the height of the Bosnia crisis, and we were given rushes, unedited footage from Bosnia. We were given four facts, and we had 3 hours to edit those rushes and write a commentary that would cover those four facts. And as the clock was ticking and as I was running out of time, I realized I'd covered three of the facts, but the fourth fact I hadn't covered because I didn't have any pictures to go with that fact. And as I ran out of time, I quietly eliminated the fourth fact just under pressure because I didn't have pictures. And that was interesting because it made me realize, of course, how image-driven the news is, but also how it's subjective. It's an edit. It's someone's opinion of what is important. It's someone's editing of reality. It's a packaging. It's looking for the story rather than admitting that there have been no developments. You know, we'll make some developments happen.
So I've been looking at your work and I've been thinking, is there a moment where you actually push it too far and sort of do that edit on your own and get in trouble? And it seems the only occurrence is an episode in your series Time Trumpet, which is a look at the present from the vantage point of the future, and there's a moment where you're doing the Terrorism Awards.
It's the Terrorism Awards. This takes place in 2012, and it's clips of the best terrorist acts of the past year. And it's a manipulated footage of an actual award ceremony that happened in the UK. And it featured the assassination of Tony Blair, and that was the BBC in its wisdom removed that. But for some reason kept in a jumbo jet flying through Big Ben. That was fine, apparently. But, you know, you negotiate these things. There's the well-known dance that you perform where, you know, if there's something you want to get through, what you do is put something even worse in. They say, can you take the worst thing out? You go, well, all right, thinking, yeah, that's fine. And then they keep in the thing that you wanted all along. So there's, you know.
And was that the jumbo jet or was that the fictional game show Rape an Ape?
No, the game show Rape an Ape was kept in.
And by 2010, this show dominated the ratings.
You'd say, I'm sorry, I can't come out, Rape an Ape is on. And that happened every Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
One catch pleasure, push your finger in.
Hook his nose.
Slow down, you're wearing him out.
Hang on tight, he's going to throw you off.
And when I saw it, I felt physically sick.
But then when I thought about it after, I thought little bits of it made me crack up laughing. And of course now, it's a classic.
She's smiling.
I know that Alan Moore does the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comic strip.
And The Watchmen.
And The Watchmen has put Rape and Ape in his vision of the future.
You know, there's a moment in the new season of The Thick of It that seems to connect back with what you were doing with this taking on the media, but even push the idea further. You have all of your characters from the fictional world make an appearance on Richard Bacon's very real Five Live BBC show. Let's listen to a little bit.
Peter Mannion, can you explain, please, why your party spin doctor has arrived entirely unannounced?
I would say it was an indication of how seriously our party is taking the allegations that we were receiving donations from
a sweatshop labour company. Well,
ooh. Do you prep them with this? Yeah.
Yeah. The last thing I said to him was go in there and bomb.
Well, I think that's worked.
Do you guys have to make so much noise?
I don't know if they told you this on your training day, love, but this is soundproof, that they can't hear you. I mean, we're like Ted Mort to them.
Look, can you please get out?
No, actually, we are entitled to be in here. In fact, they should all be in here. All of their political advisors should be in here. I'm going to get them in here.
The show night in, night out, it strikes me that one or both of you are in trouble.
Now, how does this work? How comfortable were the actors and the folks at the BBC with this sort of acid trip blurring of the lines between your fiction and reality?
Yeah, well, Richard Bacon has a popular radio show. It's a radio show. There's a phone in, but it discusses... I went on his show to promote In the Loop, and it's a funny thing because of these live radio shows, you get very contrasting items up against each other. So I was on to promote In the Loop, but coming up after midnight, he was having a more trivial discussion, Are Clowns Frightening? And therefore, while I was talking about In the Loop, 10 minutes to go before the clown debate, a fully dressed clown came into the studio ready for his appearance. And I thought this is quite funny, this. So when we decided to do our episode of The Thick of It on the Rich Bacon Show, we had him talk about a discussion about piercings. Are piercings attractive or do they scare you? Coming on after two high-level politicians were having a serious debate about the future of the economy. And it did mean that a guy covered in piercings and tattoos was sitting outside, and we fed that into the story. And then Malcolm Tucker uses the guy with piercings to try and end the debate between the politicians, because the politicians aren't going well. Isn't going well.
You're on BBC territory, though.
This was BBC territory, but they took us to their heart, really, Five Live. They were promoting the episode all week, which was great. And Richard Bacon is a great performer. He was playing himself, and he was doing it as only Richard Bacon can. And, you know, I just wanted it to feel real. So we weren't going to send the whole thing up. We just wanted to play it straight, because actually the comedy arises out of the situation. It doesn't arise out of having to mock the elements within it. It's more about the absurdity of having all these people trapped live on air in a tiny little room, you know, with nowhere to run.
Threatening
to shut the whole thing down. But that, again, that's all based on truth. You know, when senior politicians arrive and are doing discussions with their opponents, they have all their advisors behind the glass screen in the booth, who are all making faces to try and put the opponents off. You know, so they're acting like kids, really.
You know, what seems most exciting, though, is that when you take this tension between what is real and what is not real, and then you place it in the context where the stakes really matter, like in the show, the looming election, and in the film, the build-up to the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And, you know, the film is already out on DVD, but we're never really going to know exactly what happened in the build-up to the war, so your fictional version will always have a relevance and a sense of plausibility.
You think it's a document.
Yes.
You know, 1,000 years from now, there will be...
But how do you work out the dramatic tensions inherent in the fiction with the dramatic tensions of reality?
Well, it's, you know, the starting point of the story and In the Loop is based on stuff that actually happened. So there was really a secret war committee given a very dull title called the Office of Future Plans in reality, and we call it the Future Planning Committee, that Cheney tried to hide, but it was found out, so he just shut it down. There were cabinet ministers in Blair's administration who kept talking about resigning, and one of them did resign, but another one said she was going to resign and then didn't, and then did. So it all looked a little bit rubbish. That's in the film. There are various things that really happened. I went out to Washington and got lots of information about what really went on. And we made that the starting point for the film. But then once you're in the film, you've got to let the story run as it occurs in the film. So you can't keep drawing parallels with reality. We just let it run. Once you introduce the characters, the casting, the writing, you've got to just let it run its own course. What was disturbing is that, you know, we thought we were exaggerating, distorting, making things up. But actually, people would come up afterwards, politicians and so on, and say to us, how did you find that out? We thought we'd kept that quiet. You know, we played it to a lot of Washington insiders who laughed throughout. But at the end, one of them put their hand up and said, look, can we just apologize? Because that's how it happened. You know, part of you thinks, hey, we got it right. And another part thinks, oh, we got it right. And that's the disturbing thing. But, again, there's no... I keep saying it's not a documentary. You know, I'm as shocked as anyone to find out that some of these things actually did go on.
Yeah. It seems that the same thing is happening with the world of the thick of it, you know. And these connections are just, as you said, happening naturally. You're letting the story play out, and then you're watching it, or you find out that it happened. Like, for example, it seems that clearly you modeled the Tory PR guru Stewart after Cameron's real-life PR guru Stephen Hilton.
Yeah.
But in the show, at the end of season 3, Stewart's reign comes to an end with the return of a character named Cal Richard.
Yes.
As he's known. Yeah. And he's played by Tom Hollander, which is another nod to the sister world of In the Loop, where he's the mild-mannered minister, but here he plays a Tory version of Malcolm.
Yeah.
Let's listen to a little bit.
This government's run this country into the ground. This used to be a green and pleasant land. Now it's the colour of the BBC weather map. It looks like anemic dog-ish.
So he shows up at the end and we see the MP, Peter Mannion, sort of light up for the first time in the season. He's so thrilled at Cal's return. Yeah. And you realize that no one really wants touchy-feely Stewart to be in charge. And then in January it comes out that a number of real-life Tory MPs have had it with Cameron's Stephen Hilton. And they can't take any more of his new-age mumbo-jumbo. And I'm reading this article and I'm thinking, this is not actually the thick of it come to life. It's like a deleted scene or an extra or a continuation.
And the front pages were full of photographs of the real guy and plus Vincent Franklin, our actor. I get side by side. But the thing is, we base our storylines. Yes, we run with, you know, silly ideas and so on, but we base it on a fair amount of research as to what is actually going on. So from that, you can sort of guess what might be about to happen. Do you know what I mean? All these elements are sitting waiting to happen in reality. And you go ahead and sort of dramatize one of them, and it becomes as no surprise that it actually does happen. But it's not like we're sitting kind of, you know, predicting the future. You know, I've got a bucket full of obscene acts performed by commissioning editors in their early days, but I don't have a crystal ball that looks into the future. You know, when the film came out in the UK, it happened the same week that the real director of communications at Number 10 resigned for sort of a dirty tricks campaign. It was entirely coincidental, but it did mean, again, the front pages were full of Malcolm Tucker photograph plus the real communications officer, which is great for the film, but it's sad reflection on the state of real politics.
So what about for this recent season with the, you know, a real election coming eventually, how did the audience sort of respond to your fictional world explaining what's really perhaps going on with Labour?
Well, it's that strange thing of people starting to wonder if that's what it's really like. And I don't ever profess it to be a documentary or a news report. I still feel it's the duty of journalists and the media to really tell us what's going on. I get frustrated when we don't know, because what we get instead are these daily stories, you know, something that works for that day rather than something that explains what's been going on for the last, you know, 40 weeks. So I just find it interesting. You know, the stories will be interesting if I can base it on what is really going on in the background and try and bring it to the foreground.
Mm-hmm.
The other strange thing that happened was the department in the thick of it is called the Department for Social Affairs and Citizenship, or DOSAC, as it's known. Now, Cameron sat down with his strategy people and said to them that, you know, when he's elected prime minister, he wants to rename the cabinet office number 10 cabinet office, the Department for Strategy and Communication, until someone said to him, that's Bell's Dorsack. And the idea was quickly aborted.
The television series ends with the election being called.
Yeah.
And I don't know what the plans are to continue on with the program, but, you know, this, or if you've had your fill of little insignificant men and women. But you do seem to be making a statement at the end of season three when by bringing in Cal, sort of like, this is how it really works. This is how this is what you need for stories to proceed. If you're going to have a war, if you're going to have election, you need men, loud, shouty men.
Well, it's also because Cameron, the opposition leader, you know, has tried this eco-friendly tree-hugging image, which none of his party really like. But he also has now, as his chief strategist, a guy called Andy Coulson, who's the former editor of the News of the World, which is one of the, you know, the most tabloid of tabloid papers. So, you know, he has accepted that you need that sort of raw ball of fury at the heart of your political game as well. You know, so it sort of tells you things don't really change, you know. Sorry, Obama, things don't change.
This was great. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Pleasure.
This episode of Too Much Information is called Plant Fondling with Armando Iannucci. Thanks once again to Armando for taking so much time out to talk with us about his work. Check out the TMI playlist page for info on all the clips we played. And if you heard this on the radio, make sure you check out the podcast version. It will give you a much better sense of how people talk in the free world. Thanks also to our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Chris, for giving us his review of Armando Iannucci's Oscar-nominated film, In the Loop. Kara Ola recorded the interview with Armando and myself, and Bill Bowen put the whole show together. For the next 2 weeks, it's the WFMU Marathon. Check the playlist page to learn about the TMI Premium, which includes a segment called The Fourth Fact, and a whole lot more. Thank you.
campo florido. Viene el sonero cantando con un pregón repetido. Traigo la yuca y el mango en el año 1800. Y el mulato que era rumbero cantaba su pregón bien bueno.
Ecuajel.
Oye, escucha mi ritmo que es sabrosito. Yo vengo de la tierra del ay bendito. La salsa que te traigo es de Puerto Rico.
We'll be right back.
live mix by DJ Orion from Austin. You're listening to Mud Up here on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. It is 7:08, and Orion on the ones and twos. He'll be playing in New York City next Thursday, but he's here with us now, so enjoy.